Welcome to Forging Plowshares, a community dedicated to cultivating the peaceful kingdom of God. We hope this part of our ongoing conversation stimulates your mind and challenges your heart about what it means to be a follower of Jesus. Please stay tuned at the end of the podcast for a short message about our ministry.
Paul?
Hey, Michael. Good to see you, man.
Thank you, my friend. I am really honored to be with you. I was looking over your life story and the things you've done in your life, and I so want to get this book of yours, but my self-security, it's a little unaffordable.
How much is it?
Oh, my God. The hardcover is like $170. Just the Kindle volume, Kindle alone is like $35,
$36. Oh, okay. Yeah, I actually haven't looked for a while at my book, but...
No, I understand. But man, it looks good. It looks like something I want to read.
Well, it's a bit obscure, you know. But
that's all right. I'll pick it up after the first. When my Social Security check gets here, I'm picking it up.
Oh, good deal. Yeah, Lacanian. Are you familiar at all with Lacanian?
So the answer is no. I'm familiar with Girard. I knew Rene for a quarter century, and but when the first book I read his, Violence and the Sacred, he deals with Freud and Lacan. Mm-hmm. Now I'd heard of Freud as a young, I was in seminary at the time, young pastor, in fact, and but Lacan, never heard of Lacan. You know? And then eventually I would hear about Lacan, and then I would hear about Zizek, and then one day I ended up somehow in a conversation standing there with Zizek and was honored to be spit upon.
Well, if you talk to him, that's inevitable.
But yeah, I don't tend to work in those authors that you're working with. The last French author I tried to pick up and really was trying to understand was Bergson. Mm-hmm. But that's, yeah, a lot of that stuff to me is so, I find it to be a little esoteric.
Well, you know, I always found it interesting that Girard, I can't remember which book it is, but he sort of apologizes. He says, I know when you pick up a French author, you expect it to be arcane and obscure, but I'm actually quite simple. So.
Yeah, it's true.
But I do think there's a lot of overlap, and of course, obviously with Freud, mm-hmm. because what Girard is picking up in the, you know, he's obviously reinterpreting the Oedipus complex, mm-hmm. and I think rightly so. I don't think it has anything to do with human sexuality, but also then the whole orientation to death and violence. That is the part of Freud that Lacan is actually bringing out and focusing on.
So both Girard and Lacan are focused on the later Freud of Totem and Taboo, Moses and Monotheism.
That's it. Yeah. Beyond the pleasure principle is actually the point of departure when Freud poses the tripartite superego, ego, id, and Lacan is going to pick that up and focus then on the death drive, which is what Freud begins to he just kind of proposes it in Beyond the Pleasure Principle, and then in the ego and the id, you know, the superego, he sets it forth and says, well, no, this is, he embraces it. And I think Freud kind of scared off his own followers at that point.
No doubt.
Because there's no cure. In other words, and Freud began to suspect that the problem was greater than any cure. And so Lacan is one of the few psychoanalytic practitioners to take up the latter Freud of the death drive and incorporate that. You know, he is, and Zizek, I think, are complete nihilists. In other words, this is as dark as you get. But of course, that's what I'm doing in my book, is saying, yeah, it's as dark as you get, because it is an accurate portrayal of the biblical view of evil and its resolution in Christ.
Yes. So, that's beautiful, mate. That is just beautiful.
I am talking to Michael Harden. I assume no relation to John Wesley.
Family myth has the answer to that is yes. I have my question marks, but my dad decided to name my brother John Wesley Harden.
Oh no. Most notorious
That's
killer.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, right.
But you then are you've completed the work for a PhD. You've studied at North Park Theological Seminary. You've got an MDiv in 1988, but also the Tracker School. I assume this is a Native American.
That's the Tracker School out of New Jersey, where we learn the wilderness survival and shamanic skills from an Apache perspective.
Wow. Okay. And you've written many, many books. The most recent is Knowing God, Consumer Christianity, and the Gospel of Jesus, Mimetic Theory and Biblical Interpretation. You've done a couple of What the Facebook. I assume those are your gatherings of your Facebook posts.
Yes.
Reading the Bible with Rene Girard.
That's an interview. It's a series of interviews that Steve Berry did with Rene that were transcribed that I put together and edited. It's a very, very good book if you're like Girard.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Walking with Grandfather, A Skeptic's Journey to Spirituality.
Yeah, that's learning how to integrate everything I knew about Jesus with this Native American path and the trials and tribulations I went through.
So you find Christ in Native American spirituality?
No. Native American spirituality helps me find Jesus.
Okay. All right. I like that.
Yeah.
And maybe you're best known, the Jesus-driven life, which I assume is a takeoff of Rick Warren's the purpose-driven life.
That is correct.
An undoing of that, a deconstruction of that?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes.
And several more. You've got several more. I actually ran into you because of the book Stricken by God.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. With Brad Jerzak. I started showing that to everybody, which was, that's a wonderful addition. I did a interview with Brad Jerzak several years back. So
Brad is awesome. Brad is good people.
Yeah. Who, by the way, has become Orthodox.
I know. So I was referring to earlier. He's one of my friends has become Orthodox.
Yeah. So
you understand, I'm not a Maximus scholar. I'm not.
I know. Let me explain why. Are you familiar at all with the recent conversation surrounding Maximus?
No.
You know who David Bentley Hart is?
Of course, yes, yeah. Oh, yeah. Do you mean the Universalist controversies?
Yeah, well, that, but there is a young scholar, Jordan Wood. He did his dissertation at Boston University, and it's created quite a stir. You know, he and Hart are kind of in conversation.
Okay.
But Jordan Wood has taken Maximus's, you know, little saying, creation is incarnation.
Mm-hmm.
And he's taken that quite seriously. In other words, not as hyperbole or metaphor, but that this is an understanding of that Christ then is, you know, not the disincarnate Christ, but the incarnate Logos then stands behind, is the purpose of, is the becoming all in all. You know, there are passages of scripture that clearly support this. Are you familiar with the Eastern Orthodox theologian John Baer?
Oh, Father John Baer, of course.
It's very much aligned with John Baer's understanding of the interpretation of the Logos. In other words, the way that we've traditionally understood the Logos, a pre-incarnate logos. And, you know, Bear's point is that's not the pre-incarnate logos. That's just the gospel. That's the incarnate Christ. And so it's a kind of time-bending understanding, obviously. But that is that's the way that the early church fathers think of Christ. That is, they think of creation even, but certainly history, as unfolding from the center of history.
Correct.
From the cross, backward and forward.
Precisely,
It goes against the foundational sorts of rationality. It is for, in terms of Girard, in other words, part of what is happening with Girard is that we have this peaceable understanding. What needs to underlay that is an ontology or a Christology in which this peaceable kingdom is grounded. And I think this is it. So Jordan is teaching a class for Plowshares.
Yes.
And so he's going to teach a class for us on Maximus. And he references then your article. And I found your piece quite interesting because you do something in that article. In other words, there's so much intertwining of Maximus and Girard that is quite profound. It's very interesting.
Well, the thing is that makes this easy. One, Girard never read Maximus, so that's there. But Girard would say he discovered mimetic theory in the scriptures. And so would have Maximus. They're both seeing the same thing.
Right.
They're just using different language, but they're seeing the same phenomenon.
Actually, in my conversations with Jordan, this is what initially appealed me to his work, is that I saw in Maximus the ground of a peaceable ontology.
Mm-hmm.
The nonviolence actually doesn't make a lot of sense. If you're working according to the logic, the given rationale of this world, what is taking place in Maximus is, I think, a completely alternative understanding of creation and of rationality itself, taking its point of departure from the person and work of Christ.
Yes. I mean, I'm right with you on that. My work would probably be focused on the other side of that, and that would have to do with the historical Jesus, the early church, the mimetic conflicts and rivalries in the early church. For me, that issue was never settled. And then for me, most of the early church fathers really gummed it up by asking all the wrong questions, having all the wrong presuppositions, and buying into all the wrong nonsense. So I fault the early church fathers for a lot. I don't see them in the same way an Orthodox would and want to redeem their thinking. Not to say that this piece about Maximus is an exception. So I when I come at creation, obviously you've seen I wrote a book on my experiences in 20 years of Native American shamanic and wilderness survival training. My experience of creation and the beneficence of creation comes out of that. Learning the skills that we had prior to being civilized so that one could walk into the wilderness and literally thrive, you know, but they're skills that got civilized out of us. So I've learned the beneficence of creation that way. And then I've gone back and there's a fascinating book by a South African author on Jesus as a shaman. The Galilean Shaman, I think it's titled. In my thinking, this for me is one of the interesting things is when I look at the monasticism and the development of monasticism, so much of it is ascetic in its orientation and it's dealing with the issues of negative desire or what Maximus calls the need for detachment, right? What you get then is this inculcation of Christian virtue. It's done more as law or regulation rather than as gospel. But whereas in Maximus, I don't know about his monastic experience, but the 400 chapters on love certainly seem to indicate for him that there were models. There were human models of love, of generosity, of kindness, and that this is what he's thinking of is these earthly models. Now, I can't tell at that point whether he's thinking of saints or real human beings in the monasteries. I don't know. But I would want to protect Maximus from any charges of almost docetism. And that's one of the things my problem with the concept of a cosmic Christ is it's fundamentally almost always docetic. I forget the name of the author and the book but the argument was quite brilliant. He says Plato is able to go from the earth to the heavens, but he's never able to come back down.
Right, right.
You know, and Christianity's done the same thing. Again, for me, this is just for me, and I could be really reading the tradition all wrong right now, but I have a number of friends that have converted to Orthodoxy in these last years, a decade or so, you know, and they're like a lot of evangelicals. They leave that. They think they're going to go back to something ancient and, you know, really deep. I query as to whether we can afford to any longer just go back to the church fathers as though they had solved the real problems. I don't think they did. As important as the Nicene Creed is to me, personally, I grew up Roman Catholic, you know, so it's like embedded in me. The problems that it causes, the Athanasian solution leads in modern Protestantism to Apollinarian thinking, you know, and it certainly was affecting Maximus with regard to the Monotelite controversy. I really, at this point in my life, 34 years after having written this essay, and I just reread it again for the first time in probably 34 years this morning. You know, I feel like, wow, that, you know, for a young adult, that was a pretty good essay. I think I surprised myself because it made me aware of how ungenerous I have been lately to Orthodoxy and how I need to ameliorate that. That's what I'm trying to say.
I'm with you on this, that you understand that Maximus himself, of course, to call him Orthodox, and certainly the way that somebody like either Jordan Wood or Hart are understanding him, is not accepted in Orthodoxy. But if you take the development of Maximus then, and picture, I mean, I think it's accurate to call Bulgakov, Sergei Bulgakov, a development then of Maximian thinking. That is, that if you took it huge lumps from Origen to Maximus to Bulgakov. And Bulgakov and Maximus, by the way, are both very much anti-Neoplatonic. And Bulgakov, his whole entry into theology concerns the antinomies of philosophy, and he's kind of over and against a Platonic or a philosophical, and is proposing then, and I think precisely in this understanding, the resolution. In other words, if you take the idea in the person and work of Christ at Constantinople, but like you are saying, this is just kind of a negative statement. It's not an explanation. And so he's filling that out. Mm-hmm. And I think it is the resolution to a Platonic or a Neoplatonic understanding. But of course, it does that at a Christocentric understanding.
Yeah.
In other words, that in relinquishing Platonism or Neoplatonism, you're also relinquishing a form of thought that is built upon these antinomies between heaven and earth, you know, body and soul. And Bulgakov's point is, yes, these are antinomies brought together in the God-man. Here are two things that truly are opposites, mm-hmm. heaven and earth, divine mm-hmm. and human. Yes, but in the person of Christ, they are brought together, and we can't get there from somewhere else. In other words, we can't explain in a Hegelian, and I'll say this because Bulgakov is also appropriating a Hegelian understanding in a new way. I have understood Hegel, not primarily in Christian terms, but through Slavoj Žižek.
Okay.
And Žižek just reads him as an atheist. Okay. I mean, not just that Zizek is an atheist, but that Hegel is actually an atheist. But Christ did, in fact, in his person, bring together the two natures, divine and human. At some level, you know, that is the miracle of the incarnation. And so you begin there. This is the significance of Maximus. It is over and against the Platonic, the Neoplatonic, or even the traditional philosophical understanding. So I'm completely agreeing with you, but saying I think that Maximus and Bulgakov, in this understanding, also agree with you.
That's fascinating. So I took some notes here. I'd be curious. I mean, gosh, Paul, I haven't had an opportunity to get to know you, read your work, or know anything about you, but I'm just absolutely really enjoying the repartee. It's so fun, and I don't know, maybe it's just being older and sort of semi-retired that makes it fun, you know. But so when I come to the Nicene Creed, one of the issues that I've had with it has to do with the language of ousia and hypostasis and energeia and all of this language. I spent decades really wrestling with this. And sometimes, as you know, when you're wrestling with something theological and it is fundamental, you can even weep tears as you're struggling to parse this apart. And it hit me one day like a ton of bricks out of the blue that it felt to me like we're asking the wrong question when we ask about God's nature or God, the being of God. We ought to be asking about God's character, as though being could be separated from act, as though we are different than we behave, as though we're something other than the way we are in our relationships. So I proposed a mimetic reading of homoousius and suggested that simply using the language of the fourth gospel, the Son imitates the Father. The Son's only desire is for the Father. And that what Jesus brings to the table then for us is a real concrete human being undergoing theosis. And he's saying, here's how you do it. And these are going to be the way social relations work with you. Forgive 70 times 7, you know, love your neighbor, you know, all the kinds of things that go with that, which have real world effects. And one of the big reasons why I have tended to eschew orthodoxy is because all the orthodox folks I know want to do high Christology, high Trinitarian thinking, but they have no way to get to ethics. They're stuck up here in theology, la la land about natures and identity and all of this. And I guess it's, you know, my years with the Anabaptists that influenced me that have really pushed me to ask, is the doctrine of Trinity something we believe in, or that which we believe through? Is the doctrine of Trinity a hermeneutic? And if it's a hermeneutic, then what we see being displayed in the gospel is this recognition that this Janus-faced God is not the Father. Now, I don't know how Orthodox writers deal with the issue related to violence or retribution in deity. I haven't read them on this topic, how they deal with that, except through some form of allegory. That would be the only way I know they could deal with it, you know, and still somehow recognize the role that Scripture plays within their liturgical framework. So I'm curious at this point, if we could talk rather, is it possible for Orthodox to shift from that language, that Platonic language, to more, I don't know, real-world language about behavior? Right.
I don't know that we're talking about Orthodoxy here.
Okay.
Because, you know, Bulgakov, most Orthodox Christians would see him as a heretic.
Yeah, okay. So, I've got his books in my library, so...
But again, you've said it perfectly, exactly. That is, why all this esoteric discussion of the Trinity? Why does any of that matter? And I think it may not matter if we don't get what you're saying. And that is that where this is landing, where this is taking us, is a description of the canonic relationship within the Trinity. That the self-giving of the Father in the Son's self-giving love, and even Bulgakov talks about the pouring out and the kenotic giving of the Holy Spirit.
Paul, the Reformed are finally figuring it out too. Here's here's Bruce McCormick, from the Reformed theologian from Princeton, the humility of the eternal Son, but you can see they're toward a kenotic Christology. They're finally getting it.
Yeah, and that's, to my mind, the discussion about processions of the Trinity. And, well, I think if that where this comes to bear, I'm all with you here, that this pertains to the character of God as taken up in our own character. In other words, this kenotic character of God in the self-giving love of God is describing then our own imitation of who God is, of Christ's imitation of the Father, and our recognition of who the Father is in the Son.
So in my last book, Knowing God, with a question mark, because it was a wee bit of a title challenge to that famous evangelical J.I. Packer book, Knowing God.
Yeah.
So I had to have my little postmodern question mark there. What I did the first two chapters talk about consumer Christianity here in America, you know, but then I made a shift and I said, we have to start. Where's the starting point? And I did not start where most, if you look at systematic theology, start, and that is with Trinity incarnation. Mm-hmm. So you got to start with the crucifixion. Mm. Then you move to the resurrection. Then you move to the ascension. You got the high priestly work of Jesus. And then and only then can you talk about incarnation, but you have to do it in the same breath as church, ecclesiology, spirit, pneumatology, and discipleship, catechesis. Incarnation outside of that is just a doctrine. It means nothing. So Jesus is both God and man. So what? You know? But if you connect incarnation with ecclesiology, catechesis, formation, and the spirit, and you have a son-shaped spirit just as you have a father-shaped son, now you can talk about living the life of the Trinity in all of your relationships. That, to me, is the goal, to try and get people there.
We can imitate it.
We
can do this thing. And we're not only can we do it, that's who we are.
Yeah.
Oh, I like it. Yeah. Maybe this is going too far around the block, but even to talk about the cosmic Christ in a Franciscan sense or in, I think that's problematic. But I think that talking about the cosmic Christ in the sense of the crucified Christ, the resurrected Christ, in other words, are you familiar with the Vitruvian man? It was kind of the perfect image of a human being, and mathematically takes in, you know, he uses his own body. I don't know if you've seen the painting where he's spread out.
I have, yes, I have, with all of the circle lines and the Fibonacci ratios.
Right. And so it's supposed to be the perfect. And of course, the Vitruvian, the true Vitruvian man, is Christ. And not just the disincarnate or pre-incarnate, but the incarnate crucified Christ is then at the center of the cosmos. And so I think, you know, we can talk about a cosmic Christ, not in a kind of silly, you know, pantheistic understanding, but the understanding that here is the true meaning of the cosmos. Here is where this is the telos, but this is the Alpha and the Omega. And that is there in Genesis, I think, at least it's a reading of Genesis chapter 1, that, well, here is the eternal perspective in which God can pronounce creation good without qualification. I think,
you know, you just made a move, dude. You just made a move I don't know that others have made. So for you talked about Father John.
John Bear.
Yeah, Father John Bear. And then Jordan using this, I'm sorry, both, is it John Baer or Jordan? I'm not sure. Creation is incarnation. Now, let's say that's the truth. Okay. How do you account for the second law of thermodynamics in creation? How do you account for decay? You can't. Mm-hmm. You can't. But if you say the incarnate crucified is the Christ of creation, now you've brought death into the creation process itself. Mm-hmm. And death is no longer external to creation. It's part of it. It's part of that reality. And that God would undergo that death then is even more extraordinary. Mm-hmm. In order to overcome it.
That's it. That's
so it. You just made that crucified, incarnate, crucified, not just incarnation. Creation is incarnation. Creation is incarnation crucified.
Right. It is an accounting for both death and evil, understanding mm-hmm. that evil is simply an orientation to death. That it's,
that's right.
It's,
that's all it is.
Yep. I have a deep appreciation. You know, when I came to Christ as a young person, I did relate that directly to God's presence in nature. But I think there is a sense in which we have to stand back and say, yes, but we cannot, like God did in chapter 1 of Genesis, pronounce creation good without qualification. In other words, that's almost a kind of blasphemy. Taking in death, suffering, sin, evil, but taking into account Christ mm-hmm. and the resolution that Christ brings to creation, then we can understand the unqualified pronouncement, it is good.
Yeah, so I look at the first creation narrative in Genesis not as a protological text, but an eschatological text. It's announcing from the beginning how it's all going to end. And it's all going to end tov tov. My Hebrew is not brilliant, like my Greek is good, but my Hebrew is not super fantastic. But it's my understanding that when you want to make a comparative in Hebrew, you use the word twice, like tov is good. So if you wanted to say very good, you'd say tov tov. But if you wanted to say the superlative, it would be like, holy, holy, holy. That's holiest. So tov, tov, tov would be best. But the Genesis narrative, even it ends with, and God saw that it was tov, tov, but it was not yet tov, 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 mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so that's that eschatological component. It has still to be fleshed out, even though it is very good. Mm-hmm. It's not yet. It's like when you handed our dissertations to our advisors and they said, very good, but.
Yeah. I like it. Let me bring up your dissertation. How are you doing with Religion and Revelation in Karl Barth?
Well, so unfortunately, it was a beautiful blessing in 2012. The University of Canberra, through my advisors, Scott Cowdell and David Neville, basically offered me a free ride to do my PhD. And I didn't have to return back and all of this. And I gave them a list of 10 demands and they met every one of them. And so I got the piece written. So it's all written. And then 2017 came along and there was just a major catastrophe in my life at that time. My wife was very sick, got sicker. We lost the ministry we were in. We were canceled by her Christian friends because we wanted to have a big conference honoring Girard, and we didn't have enough representation of other types of persons. Sorry. So everything went downhill. And so by the time I got ready to go back, they wanted $3,000 to finish up. And I don't have $3,000, you know. And Lori's since passed. And so I'm going to publish it. You know, it's a good book. But I don't need the PhD for any reason, you know.
No,
wouldn't mean anything except be hanging on my wall, just, you know.
I didn't even have, I've got all my degrees other than that one. For some reason, I didn't have room.
That's all right.
I completely understand, but I thought it was a great topic. It would make a great
it
book.
Is it's fun. It was fun. I mean, I had spent so I discovered Karl Barth when I was really, really young, probably 19, 20 years old, maybe at best, and Dietrich Bonhoeffer at the same time. And they became my two loves through my whole life, Barth and Bonhoeffer. And I have just massed library worth of books here in my house and studied and read and read and read and read. And I just, they're my go-tos. I was, you know, hardcore Barthian when I went to the Lutheran seminary. I went to North Park Seminary, which at that time had a fantastic faculty. Unfortunately, they've kind of gone downhill and into evangelicalism. But at that time, they had Lutheran pietists as the faculty, and that was wonderful. But I was hardcore Barthian in this Lutheran seminary, you know, and it was a lot of theological fisticuffs in a good way with my fellow students, and we had a lot of that. But in when I discovered Girard in 1987, I was thrown for a loop. The mimetic theory was a paradigm shift for me. Normally, I could read a book a day. That's what my speed is. But it took me 3 days to read Raymond Schwager's book, Must There Be Scapegoats? Uh-huh. I didn't know whether I was breathing or dying while I was reading this book. I mean, everything was changing. And then I spent probably the next couple of decades, you know, just learning everything I could about Girard and mimetic theory and studying my tail end off there. And then finally, I realized I had to be able to bring Barth and Girard together in my head and figure out where the differences were and if they were significant at all. And if so, what were the moves I needed to make, you know? And that's what the dissertation was about. It was just about me unwinding that relationship that I had in my head with them. And I took satisfaction in the fact that Rowan Williams, in one of his articles, begged for someone to write a dissertation on Barth and Girard. Oh. As far as I know, nobody's done it but me.
Yeah,
you know. So, but I'm sure others will do it, and others better acquainted. With
I'm curious because thinking about it on the surface, that in Girard, of course, revelation is a necessity because of the deception of the scapegoating mechanism. Mm-hmm. In other words, the only way you're going to expose the scapegoat mythology is in and through the work of Christ. But doesn't that directly correspond to Barth's picture of revelation also? This is not an addendum. This is not in correspondence with. This is a breaking in an apocalyptic kind of exposure of sin as a deception and a lie.
Yeah, you can find that in Barth. Barth will in fact say revelation is reconciliation. It effects something. And what it affects is the reconciliation of enemies. And if there's enemies, then there's been transgression somewhere. So that can all get dealt with, in, you know, and there is that congruence there. What to me, I wish Barth had seen this, but I can understand why he didn't. And that's that revelation has to come into the mechanism of religion in order to be the viral component that infects it and kills it. You can't have revelation outside of religion. It has to come at the heart of religion, and the heart of religion is ritual. And, of course, then the explication of that myth and prohibition, so the pillars of culture. If revelation doesn't come in the heart of that, if God can't become that which we created theology before the Father started revealing the Father's self. We created gods. And our gods are Janus-faced. You know, they like us, they hate you. They bless us, they curse you. And then, you know, how gods, eventually the sky gods and all that. Okay. So we create Janus-faced gods. If you're a non-violent, loving, pacific deity, how do you begin to come into this kind of thinking? Well, you have to take your time, don't you? You have to prepare a people for it. And that, to me, is the beauty of God's work with the people of the Jewish people throughout the what we would call the biblical salvation history.
This is the Lacanian overlap, by the way. This is why Girard and Lacan go right together. That Lacan, Zizek are describing human subject as being structured around a deception. In other words, the primordial deception of it, it is a dynamic of a lie, and that is Lacanian psychoanalysis. But that, in other words, Girard is focused then on the human society, you know, mimetic desire is deceived.
It absolutely is. I mean, in this sense, you could say Girard has a robust doctrine of original sin, but it's not moral, it's social.
We're enculturated into it.
We are enculturated in it. We're born into it. We're enculturated in it. We are given broken models in our parents. We become broken models to our kids, you know, and we just keep passing on these defects.
But not to defend Eastern Orthodoxy, but the alternative to an Augustinian original sin is this kind of cultural, sociological inculcation. You know, we're enculturated, and that is our fallenness.
Yes, that is our fallenness. And do you know, this is, again, Maximus is so good here, because what he does, in at least in the 400 chapters, is he's pulling us away from every element of culture, every element, whether it's prosperity, the need for recognition, again, money, pride, status. He just demands detachment from all of these and reattachment to the incarnate crucified, who is love.
Reorientation of desire.
Reorientation of desire, yeah.
Desiring God.
Yeah, I was really surprised rereading this essay, particularly the little section on Maximus. I had no idea, again, it's been 34 years, that one could derive so many of these intricate kind of ways of Girardian thinking that one finds in René's works right there in Maximus. Mm-hmm. It just was stunning.
Can you run down in kind of a broad way the overlap between Girard and Maximus?
If I'm allowed to use my own essay, I'd be happy to do that.
Great, great.
I mean, when I got the invitation from you 4 or 5 days ago, I looked at my fiance and I said, "Oh Lord, I don't remember anything at all. I've got to go find the journal article." So I'm just going to read some of the sentences that would answer that question. The first, like Girard, Maximus perceives the dynamic of human relations as structured according to an imitative quality. So they're both recognizing this business of imitation, which of course now has been biologically verified with the discovery of mirror neurons in the 1990s.
But don't skip over that. That's key. Explain that a little bit.
The mirror neurons. Yeah. Okay, so yeah, it was in 1996 or 1997 in UCLA, in a laboratory there. Scientists working on rhesus monkey brains discovered that when certain actions were done in front of them, certain areas of their brain lit up, and they created an apocryphal story to describe this. Because I think the real thing is much more boring. But their apocryphal story goes like this. One day, a researcher walked in the lab, and this monkey was wired up, and he's just watching the researcher, and the guy's hungry, so he walks over and he picks up a banana. Well, the monkey's brain lights up the same way it would light up had the monkey picked up the banana. Then the guy peels the banana, and doggone, if the monkey's brain doesn't light up the same way as if the monkey had peeled the banana. Of course, when he eats it, the monkey's brain is lighting up as though the monkey's eating it. Our brains cannot distinguish fantasy from reality. They can't. And we are constantly looking to others to know what to want. In other words, humans are the only species that once their needs are satisfied, they have wants. And we learn to turn to others for our wants. And then when we want something, we think it's our own, so we look to others to validate our want. We want them to want what we want, but we don't want them to want it so much they take it. Right? So Maximus sees this, Girard saw this, and the discoverers of the mirror neurons also saw it. It's amazing to me you can have a 7th century church father, a 20th century literary critic slash anthropologist slash whatever Rene is, and then these neurophysiologists, that they're all saying the same thing. So there's got to be something to this. So does that help?
Yeah. That's wonderful. That's exciting. And so in the mimetic realm, this is the makeup of what personhood is.
All I have to do, all any of us have to do, is take an honest look at our life. And if I go down to my basic, what I call my basic needs, it's not a need, it's a want, but it feels like a need, and that's the need for recognition. Well, where did that come from? And I can go through my whole adult life and all the ways I'm looking for recognition, you know, publishing and doing all the things that we do ministry-wise and all that stuff. But I can go back further into my childhood and I can see where, you know, I have come from a very broken family where there was no recognition. In fact, for me, growing up, if I didn't get hundreds, I got punished. If I got a 99, I got punished. Mm. So I grew up in that kind of world where perfection was expected. And so my whole life has been this, and I've had to learn to detach from that. I've had to learn to let it go. And it's writers like Girard or Maximus or St. Francis has been my big go-to for this, that has helped me to let that go, you know, that, and now that I'm 67, you know, I just don't give up, you know.
Yeah.
A rat's derriere.
Yeah. What you've just described, let me read this passage, and I think it captures it. This is from your article. He says, thing, representation, and passion are different realities. A thing is, for example, a man, a woman, gold, and so forth. A representation, for example, a simple recollection of any of these things. Passion, however, is an irrational affection or senseless hate for any of these things. Run that down for us. I thought that was a very interesting breaking it down.
So as you're reading this, I'm thinking immediately of the garden myth in Genesis. A thing is an apple, but the apple also represents God's command. There is a passionate response, in this case, irrational, to disobey the command. You know, it's reverse psychology. You want someone to do something, tell them not to do it. Don't eat the apple guarantees they're going to eat the apple.
Yeah. Don't eat those.
Bad form, yeah. Bad form on the God of the text. Right. You know?
Yeah.
So the thing gets represented, the suddenly it's the seeing, it's the desiring, it's the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, that we've
got. It's going to get amplified. Remember, it's going to get amplified as we imitate each other's desires. It's going to get amplified. So you and I are high school buddies and we're palling around and this new girl comes to the school and I say, man, she's pretty. I'm gonna go ask her out on a date. Well, you wouldn't pay any attention to her. Now you notice she's pretty. So you up the ante and you go ask her on a date first. Now, all I did was say she's pretty. You upped it and now we're rivals. The point being that there's always going to be an escalation of passion from the thing to the representation to the irrational grasping. There has to be that lie that says it's just a thing and it's mine, I can take it. I don't know, have you had an opportunity to do work on the hymn in Philippians 2 that Paul cites, the who be in the form of God, not consider equality with God? Okay. In a mimetic reading of that and following C.F.D. Mole on this, harpagmos is not a thing to be grasped, but with the type of noun that it is, who did not consider equality with God to consist in the act of grasping. And so Philippians 2 is if you parallel it with the Genesis text, it's a Christ-Adam parallel there. Mm-hmm. And the most important thing is not grasping.
Oh, I like that. I like that.
Yeah, letting go. Letting go. And then you got to wonder, well, that kind of thing's entered pop culture through AA, through Frozen, right? Let it go, let it go, let it go. We just don't realize as human beings the importance of those three little words. Let it go. Because once you let it go, you've given up control. And then you can be at peace.
Maybe I'm better at the negative part of it. And that is, you know, as soon as there's a rivalry, we're playing a zero-sum game. There's only one girl,
that's
as
right.
far as we're concerned.
That's right, unless she's polyamorous.
That's right. That's right. So, yeah, no, that's, I like that. I hadn't actually heard that about, it is a definition of kenotic love, self-giving love, over and against the Genesis account. That's brilliant.
Right. Without wanting to plug my book, it's in my book, The Jesus-Driven Life. I do a lot of this work in there.
All right. Yeah. And that was kind of one of your best sellers, wasn't it?
Still is.
Is it?
Still is up there. People are buying it. Yeah. And I self-published it, so I know how it's doing.
Yeah, my book, I'm getting royalties, but the royalties have not accumulated enough that in England they can afford to send me the royalties without it costing more to send them than the amount of the...
Well, you know those publisher contracts, the first 500 don't count, review books don't count, you know, it's like, you know, lucky libraries, you hope that at least 500 libraries buy a copy of it, right?
So this is the thing I brought out, and maybe we've already hit it. That is that the passions are hidden in the soul and are revealed when the object appears.
That's correct. I don't know what I want until somebody points it out to me. That's right.
And so the object cause of desire, or the obstacle cause of desire, is the Lacanian way of saying this thing. In other words, it's something, it may be an object, but actually what makes the object desirable is that it's unobtainable.
It's in the midst of a model obstacle relation. The model has pointed it out and said, be like me. But the model also gives a double bind in that Gregory Bateson sense. Don't be me. Don't take what I have, but like what I like. Mm-hmm. Right?
This is the scandal, as I understand it, in Scripture.
Yes.
The scandal is the object cause of desire, in which the obstacle is the cause. In other words, the obstacle becomes the entire focus.
Yes.
And the object almost drops out of sight, or could drop out of sight.
I think this is why it's so important. And I don't know how the historical Jesus managed to process all of this at a young age, but that he chooses to remain celibate or in a eunuch-like state, that he chooses to carry no money, that he chooses to abandon family. He has nothing anybody would want, absolutely nothing anybody would want, till he starts doing miracles. So he does them. And then you get to the big event, the feeding of the 5,000, you know, and it's at that moment the crowd says, this is our guy, let's make him king. And it's at that point in the Gospels, Jesus says, now I'm a dead man. It's all over. They've turned him into a mimetic rival of Herod or Caesar.
Or in John, the raising of Lazarus
brings
on his death.
Yeah, it does. And in fact, it almost brings on Lazarus' death, because the plot's against both of them.
Right, right. That it's too much in some way. Mm. What you're doing, I may have rethought your article here too strongly. In other words, what Gerard is doing for us, what you're describing, is kind of the genealogy or the anatomy of human violence. And human violence we can equate with evil and sin.
Yes.
Is
well,
it
we can equate it with deception and death. It's evil and sin are nouns that you can put any kind of theological, but lies, we all know what a lie is.
Mm-hmm.
We all know what death is. And Jesus said, you have your father, the Satan mechanism. He's a liar and a murderer, and the two belong together. Deception and death go hand in hand. I thought that you had said that earlier, actually, quite clearly.
He was a liar and a murderer from the beginning.
Yeah.
Satan, and I'm going to say this, and then if you disagree or if I'm misunderstanding, the Satan, maybe mm-hmm. small s,
correct.
Is this mimetic rivalry, is this deception, so that the undoing of the deception is the dissolving of the satanic.
Absolutely. So for me, the Satan is not a spiritual being. It's I don't follow the Book of Enoch in this, you know. For me, we are the Satan. Early on in our hominization process, and however long that took, we are the product of a process that has created an angry God, a violent God, a retributive God, a God of transaction. And so the Satan, the satanic, how do I say this? The satanic is the Janus-faced God. I've often wondered, you know, as kind of a postmodern Protestant, so to speak, about the history of Christianity. And, you know, we can look at it through the lens of kind of a Howard Zinn, you know, and see all the bad stuff. But there is so much good stuff that is coming through the effects of the gospel on human culture. And I said to myself, why did Christianity have to become a sacrificial religion? You know, it certainly wasn't that way for Paul or John, or the writer of the fourth gospel, I should say. It wasn't that way. Why did it become, it had to become a sacrificial religion? It did, and it had to have this long-lasting effect of 2,000 years, so that here at the end of the, where we're at today, whatever you want to call it, the gospel is being set free from this sacrificial view of Christianity, the gospel, the announcement that the Father is love, the Father is light, there is no shadow of turning. It is being set free from that. The gospel's not being set free from the best parts of the tradition. It is articulating the best parts of the tradition, but it's being set free from that sacrificial matrix that it's been under now for, well, going back to the Jerusalem church, at least on that side of things, and certainly from Constantine forward. And for the life of me, I've never understood how in the world Constantine could be considered a saint. Somebody's going to have to explain that to me.
yeah, one of the Orthodox saints. Yeah, that's
not in my book.
So,
I'm too Anabaptist for that.
Yeah. Are you reading this then back into the New Testament, that there is a sacrificial element in parts of the New Testament?
Absolutely. So just as there is religion in the Jewish canon, there's also revelation in the Jewish canon, because there's three types of victims. There's the victim of myth, who has no voice, and the victim of myth often will agree with the accusers, like Oedipus does in the Oedipus myth. There's the victim in travail, and the first literature, and Gerard pointed this out, the first literature that gives us the voice of the victim is the Bible. Abel's blood cries out from the ground, but it cries out for vengeance, and we see this in the Psalter and some of the prophets and John the Baptist. This is a victim in travail, innocent, but not yet in gospel mode. And then the gospel victim's the forgiving victim. Violence stops here. There's no retribution, no retaliation. And this is especially seen for me in the first words of the risen Christ to the disciples, the ultimate eschatological words. He comes from the future with the ultimate eschatological word, shalom. Don't be afraid. I'm not the kind of God you think I am, and my Father's not the kind of God you think he is. Don't be afraid.
Forging Plowshares is a community dedicated to cultivating the peaceful kingdom by providing in-depth transformative biblical and theological education and discipleship. If you have found this podcast valuable, please remember to share on social media. If you have questions about what you've heard, or if you'd like to learn more about how you can get involved with Forging Plowshares or even support this ministry financially, please visit our website, forgingplowshares.org.